All right, before we kick into this episode, I just have a quick favor to ask. If you would do me the honor of heading over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to Slow Down Man, and subscribe, first of all. And if you are on Apple Podcasts, if you can go and leave a written review, an honest review, honestly, means the world. Really appreciate it. Appreciate you listening, and enjoy this episode. All right, guys, so as mentioned on the show before, I believe we're so much more capable than what we're showing on a daily basis. So I'm excited about this one. We've got a guy who's all about continual growth, and so much so that he's written a book about it. Welcome to the show, Jared Graybeal. Thanks for slowing down with us, my man.
Yeah, thanks for having me, brother.
Before we kick into anything, I just want to acknowledge something that's really cool, and that thing that's really cool is your middle name. It's Axel. And can you just share why where that came from?
Yeah, Guns N' Roses. My dad's a big Guns N' Roses fan, and I was born in 1990, so sort of probably the prime of heavy metal hair bands type of vibe. So named after a rock star.
Dude, I love it. GNFNR.
Yeah.
What a way to kick it up. Okay. And also, before we get really into it, there's two very interesting points that I found when I was creeping your website, preparing for this. The first was that you started your first business when you were 11 years old. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, technically, you know, it's a sort of a story, but you could call it that. Yeah.
Okay. What was that business?
So when I was a kid, we grew up really low income, extremely low income. I mean, we were like the poor people in the poor neighborhood. And so going to school, I had free lunch and didn't have money for the Mountain Dews. And so, but I always wanted to fit in, and I wanted the things that the other kids had. So I've always been capitalistically driven and entrepreneurial and pretty creative. So we in early sixth grade, I knew these two kids. They were twins. And they would steal anything. And so on the way to school, we skateboarded to school. They'd go in this gas station, steal a bag of like popsicles, candy, and then I'd sell it at school. And I'd sell it for a quarter a pop, you know? And then I stopped leaning on them after, you know, the first go around and began to buy the bag. And because I've never, like, as a kid, when other people would go into the store and steal, I was never good at that. I feel like everybody's watching me. So I'd be the one at the counter talking to them. Anyways, so I'd buy this $3 bag of popsicles and go back to school the next day and sell each one. I think there was, we'll say 30 or something like that. And I'd make like $10. And that was really my first thing. And as a skateboarder, I got pretty good at skateboarding quickly. And I would get a bunch of free stickers from the skate shops, and eventually got sponsored by a skateboarding shop. And so I would sell those stickers at school because skateboarding was really cool at the school that we went to. And so I'm talking about $2 to $5 a sticker. I'd leave school with $20,
which is a lot of money at that age, right? It's a lot of money.
Yeah. Especially for someone like me, where I couldn't tell you the last time my dad gave me any money for anything. And so I used that money to support my new pot smoking habit. Feel old saying pot, weed, and began to buy weed with the $20, $30 that I had. And that evolved into me becoming your neighborhood weed salesman. And so I remember buying like a $30 bag of weed in sixth grade. And then I knew all the other little kids needed weed, and I had it. So they were like, man, I'll give you $5 for whatever. And so I ended up selling like six kids these little nickel bags, and I still had some. And I was like, wait, I made my money back, but I still have some left. And I could either sell this and profit or keep it and have free weed. And so it was like, well, I bet I could do both. And so I did. And that became somewhat of an enterprise over the next 6 years of my life. But yeah, that's my early 11-year-old entrepreneurial journey.
Wow, dude, I love it. I love all the evolutions of it. It started off illegal in stealing and selling. And then you're like, no, I'm going to buy it. I'm not going to do this illegal stuff. And then transform it to a pot operation of some sort. And wow, that's where it all started. But yeah, I'm sure that comes from an entrepreneurial drive deep down, right?
Yeah.
Right on. The other thing I have to ask about before we, as mentioned, really get into it. But you also mentioned that you learned everything you know about time management when you were on house arrest for 2 years. Can you elaborate on that one for us?
Yeah. So, for the audience, just in case they're not aware of what things used to be like, but selling weed was frowned upon prior to it being legal in most places. And when you sell like a massive, what I would consider to be a massive amount back then, you get in trouble. And so by the end of my senior year, I finally got caught because I had really a kind of a complex operation for a teenager, and ended up going to jail the summer after my senior year.
Ooh.
I spent 2.5 months in jail, in county jail. Some people would be like, oh, that's a vacation. But if you've ever been in Polk County jail, you would know that 2.5 months is a lifetime. And when I got out, I had to serve 2 years on house arrest and then 2 years on probation after that. Hmm. And on house arrest, you are basically a prisoner of your home, which is far better than jail. So I'm not complaining necessarily. But a part of the process is every Sunday you have to go to your CO's office. Your CO is your correction officer or your parole officer, however you want to look at it. And you give them a schedule, a printout that you get prior. And it literally has 168 hours on it. It's Sunday through Sunday or whatever. And you have to detail what you'll be doing every hour of each day. Because this is a type of house arrest. You don't have an ankle bracelet. Basically, it's almost worse because you have the freedom to break the rules. And so, you put in your sleep or home. It doesn't really matter if you're sleeping, if you're home. And then for me, it would be, like 9 to 1 work, 2 to 5 school. I was full-time college, full-time working, studying to be a trainer. And of course, just at home the rest of the time. You got 1 hour a week to go to Walmart specifically to get your groceries.
Specifically Walmart.
Wow. Yeah. And if you forgot to put it on your schedule, then you don't get to go grocery shopping. And if you forgot that middle of the week, you can't call your PO and be like, hey, I need groceries. Like you're out of luck. You're not emailing this guy or DMing him,
You're just not eating.
Yeah. Or your friends hopefully can bring you some food. There wasn't Uber Eats back then. There wasn't Postmates. So, you had to be extremely, and for me, I was not okay with being home if I didn't have to be. I wanted to be as productive as possible with my time. And so, for example, I was a college student, and let's say you wanted to stay after class and talk to the professor. That has to be scheduled. There's no serendipity or randomness when you're on house arrest, right? You can't just go with the flow and be like, oh yeah, I got caught up at school and stayed for 3 hours. Like, no. You put that in your thing and you say what you're doing with who, and you leave the phone number for the professor if you're staying after class. So I had to learn the hard way how to plan my day to day extremely well so I could get a lot done and not be stuck at home, because I didn't want to be stuck at home. So that just has translated into how I manage my time now. Like I said, when I was on house arrest, I was full-time school, full-time college, studying to be a trainer. When my corrections officer would let me go to the gym, I would go to the gym. He didn't let me go very often because he didn't think that that's what I was actually doing. Funny story. About 2 years later, after I got off, and I was the only one to ever get off without going to prison. It's not designed for people to succeed. Officer Collins walks into my gym. At this time, I'm a sales manager at a gym. Yeah. And he walks in and he signs up for a membership with me. And he says, Jared, if I would have known you were telling the truth about the gym this whole time, I would have let you go. And I'm like, well, Collins, I was going anyways, but here we are.
Yeah.
So I signed him up and I had to see him every day. Yeah. And he would always tell me how proud he is of me. And this guy is not a very nice guy. So him to be like scolding, he would scold and be like, I'm proud of you, Jared. And I'm like, I feel like I'm still in trouble. You know, like, anyway, so yeah, that's my time management story.
Oh man, what a story, first of all. And so now would you say that you do that with your days? Like it's very structured, this time to this time I'm doing this, this time to this time I'm doing this. Like same kind of idea.
Yeah, almost to a fault. And I say almost because I don't think that it's necessarily a fault, but I could be erring on the side of maybe a little too meticulous at times. So I try to stay cognizant of that, which is where kind of the clarity chapter comes into play. But yeah, man, I do what I call time budgeting. And just like a well-groomed financial steward does with their money, right? If we're responsible adults, then we budget our money. Not everybody does, but if we're responsible, we do.
Right.
We got to do the same thing with our time. Most people don't. And the thing about time is it's the most consistent thing that we can rely on. God gives us 168 hour budget every week. This is your allowance and everyone gets the same budget. And so, you know, for people to be like, I'm not, you know, like Steve Jobs had the same time that you or I do. So does Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, you know, Tim Ferriss, all these people. And so, I like to budget my time. And so I take 168 hours and I know that I'm going to sleep 56 hours of it every week, hopefully for the rest of my life. Right. So automatically I've only got 112 hours left. And then I know that I like to train 15 hours a week. I work out a lot, right? So automatically I've got 97 hours left. Then I work, right? We'll say 50 hours a week. I've got 47 hours left. I eat five times a day and it takes about 15 minutes for me to eat. So I know that eating is, we'll just say an hour and a half of my day. So 90 minutes times seven, and that's another 10 hours. So I take 10 hours out of my time budget. Because if you've ever made a full schedule of your day and you're block to block midway through your day, you're like, I didn't make time to eat and this is horrible. So I budget everything. And so I try to allot, like 4 to 6 hours a week of hanging out with my friends, and I'm strategic and intentional about it.
Yep.
And I'm not crazy about it, but I am like, oh man, I haven't hung out with Alex in a month. Let me reach out to him, see if we can get something on the schedule next week. Boom, 2-3 hours. You know what I mean? Because I never want to be that entrepreneur that's so successful, but never spends time with his friends or isolates himself.
Right.
And I can default into that person, even though I'm an extrovert. I love a lot of the projects I work on. And so, so I have to budget my time. And so that's what I do with my time. And, I'm biased, but I believe that it allows me to be extremely productive and live a fulfilling life. And I think that's what the goal is.
I love that that's the goal. And, you know, as they say, through structure comes flexibility. And it sounds like that's kind of what you've captured through this, maybe at times overly structured way of looking at your time. But I love that. I've never heard of anyone budget their time to that extent, to be honest with you. But when you think about it, like, time is an asset. It is something that we all have a finite amount of. I've never budgeted it to that extent, but I have started to be more conscious of like, okay, I spent an hour looking at this sports articles today. Like what else could I have been doing during that time? Could I have spent 20 minutes doing, you know what I mean? Just being more conscious of like, what things am I doing on a day-to-day basis? And how are these affecting, you know, my fulfillment at the end of the day, with that being the goal. I love that. Yeah. And I love how you mentioned you schedule time with your friends as well. You make sure you work that into the schedule, and you have a quote in your book. And the quote is, any success I have is a product of the connections I've been blessed to create over the years. Which I think ties into the fact that you literally schedule this into your day. Can you just talk about what that means to you a little bit?
Yeah, I think that everyone is literally one connection away from changing their life in the most dramatic way. When you look at these big stories, go back to like Steve Jobs, who I'm fascinated with, I'm sure a lot of people are. And his serendipitous encounter with Steve Wozniak. And you look at sort of like the PayPal story where you have the PayPal mafia and how all these guys met and then they've all gone on to do some amazing things. You look at the Mark Zuckerberg story and how he met Sean, Napster Sean, in Silicon Valley on a little vacation at a house they rented in a neighborhood. They met him and then he introduced Zuckerberg to Peter Thiel, which was his first investor. And so it's like these connections radically define an era we're living in. We live in a technology, we live in a Facebook Apple era where right. these things were designed at like an Elon Musk era, right? Like these things happened because of connections. But you know, we live in a more isolated ecosystem even prior to COVID, because social media and like the digital era has sort of brought us into this, these small bubbles. I think introversion is going to be a lot more common because of Gen Z and the digital era. And so it's like, I don't think people are emphasizing how important external connections are. And I want to make a point of that. And I want to make a point of how easy it is to practically increase your connections on a regular basis, whether or not you're extroverted or introverted. And so for me, what that quote means is that, again, I was raised, we didn't have anything. My dad raised us on his own for the most part. And I remember one of my first serendipitous encounters. I was in like this little neighborhood that we lived in, and I was exploring this little side alley, and I ran into a kid named Nash, and Nash had a little brother named Zach, and we connected and became, you know, we just played, I don't know, ball or something like that. And then I became best friends with them, and their mom, Kate, really took me in and began to sort of be like another parent for me, which really helped because my dad was working a lot. And then that allowed me to learn what it's like to socialize with other humans instead of moving around so much like we did. That allowed me to become a social creature. I ended up going to an elementary school where Zach went. He introduced me to his friends. I didn't have to be this loser new kid. And so like, that's an example of a very early stage of me just being like, hi, I'm Jared. And he's like, hi, I'm Nash. Right. You know, like we, and then we meet, but you know, for example, Superfit Foods was not my idea, the company that I own. And I was a trainer at a gym, and a guy named Frank had reached out, and Frank was a business guy. And I was in a season of my life where I wasn't really interested in meeting with any business people, but he was like, hey man, let's get coffee and just chat about what your goals are. And I was like, all right. And so I did. And Frank was like, you're a business guy. You know that you don't want to train one-on-one forever. What's your next step? And I was like, I don't know what it is. I had a gym that didn't work out for me. So that's kind of a little bit part of that story. And he was like, what about meal prep? You're a nutrition expert. You're a fitness guy. I bet we could do well there. And I was like, that's a great idea. Let's run with it. And so by stepping out of your comfort zone and making these connections, you don't have any clue how that's going to propel you into the next phase of your life. But if you're always withholding that ability to make connections, you'll always stay in the same place and you'll never live a life of constant growth.
Right. I love that, because I think the power of a connection sometimes can be understated.
Yeah.
They're huge, right? Literally, they could be life-changing.
Yeah. I mean, you could be in a coffee shop. Your future wife could be sitting across the table from you. You could be in the gym, and your next best friend that's going to get you through a hard season could be on the bench press next to you. Your next business partner, your next, I mean, who knows, right? Like, but if you don't consciously and intentionally make these connections, then you'll never know.
Yeah. 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 And dude, I agree. I think we've been shifting for a while towards like isolating ourselves, like you say, even before COVID, with these apps and most communication these days is not like we're doing right now face to face. It's through messaging, it's through group chats and stuff like that, which is great. You're keeping in touch with people, but it's not the same. Right. And I think the shift towards that has eliminated to extent or discouraged just chatting people up in public. And COVID for sure has discouraged this for obvious and apparent reasons. But and I hope we're going to shift back the other way. I'm hopeful that's the, you know, eventually we're going to realize like, whoa, we're really isolated. There's no more face-to-face connection. Let's shift back towards a little bit of more authentic communication. But yeah, we'll see. What do you think on that? Do you think we're going to see a shift the other way?
Yeah, man, we're social creatures by nature. We will inevitably always be a community-oriented species. It's how we survive. We don't survive in isolation, and we certainly don't thrive in isolation. So we will always, I mean, like the influenza epidemic or pandemic that happened 100 years ago did relatively the same thing. People stopped shaking hands. And none of us even think about the influenza pandemic 100 years ago. Like, when was the last time you didn't shake your hand because of that? Right. So it's just, it's like we are habitual. Give it a couple more months, we'll be shaking hands again. You'll be hugging people. So yeah, maybe not a couple months, maybe more time. But yeah, we will go back.
Right. Okay. Hey, good to hear you share that that view. Let's talk a little bit about your book, which, as mentioned, is about growth, the self-help book. Self-help book, Six Practical Ways to Never Stop Growing is his name. And let's start here. You mentioned a statistic, and the statistic is of 2,000 people interviewed, 69% felt trapped in the same routine, and over 40% are generally unhappy with their lives because of it. A couple of questions for you on this shocking statistic, Jared. A, why do you think so many people feel stuck? And B, why are so many people just willing to stay in this place of unhappiness?
I think we get stuck for a couple reasons. One of the reasons is that we just stop learning. I think after traditional schooling, organized schooling, like high school or college, we either are burnt out on being forced to learn, or we just don't think that we need to learn anymore. We get the job out of college and we live the status quo life. And then that's it for some people. And that can lead to a lack of fulfillment in life and, of course, a lack of self-growth. So the first reason, I think, is that people just stop learning because they don't want to, or they're not inspired to continue to learn in their new career. There's a lot of great jobs out there that inspire or catalyze consistent growth. But then, there's a lot that aren't doing that. Another reason is that we don't set goals. And even for those that do, they set goals and they suck at it. And what I mean by that is setting goals that you can't clearly define or you can't measure or quantify, right? So if I set a goal this year to be a nicer person, how do I know if I reached that goal? You know what I mean? If I set a goal to quote unquote be better with my money, how do I measure that, right? And so you have to reverse engineer whatever that vague nuanced goal is and define it and say, okay, quote unquote, being better with my money means I need to pay down my debt and save $5,000. That's my goal for this year. Okay, how do I pay down my debt? Well, first I got to identify how much do I have. I have 17 grand in debt. Okay, realistically, what can I put aside? And then you begin to do the work of reaching that goal. But most people don't set goals. And for those that do, they don't reach them because they don't set clearly defined ones. And so people live a life of monotony or kind of doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And then they complain when they're not experiencing growth or change. And it's because you have to catalyze that own change in your own life or somebody else will.
Ooh, boom. Okay. I love that. Let's go down the goal setting tangent for a little bit here. I know New Year's just passed us and you know, there's a lot of talk in 2020 about the COVID-19, aka putting on 19 pounds, you know, while in isolation. So I would imagine, Jared, that there's some ambitious New Year's goals being set this year. But everyone knows that the stigma around New Year's resolution setting is that a lot of people, the gyms are so busy in January. Everyone goes back to the gym. They're hitting it hard for 3 weeks, a month, a couple of months, maybe. And then they fall back into their monotony routine that you, their position of comfort that you kind of described there. Why does this happen? What is wrong with their goal setting strategy that is causing them to not be successful at that?
Yeah, I think it goes back to just generally being bad at setting goals. And this is something I talk about in the book, but you know, throughout schooling, we're taught a lot of subject matter. But one thing we're not taught is how to set goals. And if we're supposed to live a life of consistent growth and more importantly, contributing to society, which is what school should be about, is like empowering children and then right. young people, and then teenagers to contribute to society so we can create this productive cycle, then we should be teaching people how to set goals, but we don't. We give them assignments. They finish those assignments with usually irrelevant subject matter, and then they move on to the next year and they kind of do an advanced version of that. And so we haven't been taught how to set goals really well. And an acronym that I use, which I think was coined by a sort of a goal setting expert, Brian Tracy, and he's been around for a long time. It's a SMART goal setting acronym. Specific. Your goals have to be specific, measurable, attainable, right? Mm-hmm. Is it attainable? If you set a goal to save $100,000 this year, but you make 50 grand a year, you're not going to reach that goal, but you're not going to feel bad about it because you didn't set an attainable goal in the first place.
Right.
And then relevant. Some people set goals just to fit in with others. Is it relevant? Does it matter to you? Because if it doesn't, you're not going to reach it. And then is it time based? Like, it has to have a time attached to it. So instead of saying, I need to be better with my money this year, that's not very specific. It's not measurable. Mm-hmm. It's not attainable because it doesn't make any sense. It's not relevant. And it's not time-based. Well, it's kind of time-based if you say this year, right? So a more specific version was, I want to get out of debt. Okay, now we're on to something. It's measurable. How much debt do you have? Okay, now the goal is I need to pay down 17 grand worth of debt. Is it attainable? Can I pay 17 grand worth of debt when I'm only making 35 this year? No. So what's an attainable version? Let me pay 25% of my debt. That's, you know, $4,250, right? Yeah. Okay, now we're on to something. Is it relevant? Sure. Saving money is relevant. Is it time-based? I want to do that in 2021. Okay, that means I need to save $50 a week every week for the next 52 weeks. So if you begin to detail the minutia, you hold yourself accountable, and now you're going to reach this goal. But if you don't, you can clearly explain why, because you broke it down into pieces.
Right. Oh, that's good. The smart approach. I love it. And I think that's so true. A lot of goals that I know I've set for myself in the past, it was like, a lot of the time it's like, there's a lot of gray area in the goal, a lot of ambiguity around what I actually want to do. Or it's just not attainable. It's just an insane goal. But the one that really caught my attention is relevant, is the R. It's like, do you really want this thing? Is this just like, you see that, oh, people are losing weight this year. Like, oh, I should probably lose some weight, I guess. Maybe. Yeah. I want to lose 10 pounds in 2021. And I know I found that it's like, if I've set goals in the past where I'm just like, oh yeah, I want to put on some muscle or something. Like, I just want to get in better shape. But I didn't really want that. Like, I was just like, oh, I feel like I should do that. But more recently I've aligned it more with like, when I'm an old man, I want to be able to lift my grandchild. And then it's like, now I really want it. Now it's easy to go to the gym, to put in the reps. You know what I mean? I guess what is your personal experience with that, with making goals relevant to you?
Well, you know, for example, we live in like the age of entrepreneurship. It's so cool or sexy to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah. And
that's become this word that's, not really clearly defined, but some people are, in my opinion, designed, or God has created them to be a part of somebody else's team. And so if it's all the rage to start a business, that doesn't mean that one of your goals should be to start a business. You might be the best right-hand man to some large corporation. You might be a great group leader for a different ministry. Or, you know what I mean? So you don't always have to start your own thing, especially if you're not a starter. Not everybody's a starter. You can be a leader without being a starter. And so that's just an example. I know so many young people that are like, I want to start a business. And I'm like, well, what kind? I don't know yet. So you just want to start a business to start a business? Do you have a problem you want to solve? No. I just always knew that I wanted to start a business.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, and that might be true, but it's not very relevant. And so that's an example, right? And so, again, let's say you're a bodybuilder and you set a goal to run a certain distance. It's like, well, man, you're a pro bodybuilder. is a marathon really relevant to your actual lifestyle goals this year, like who you want to become? You know what? You're not. I just had a friend that ran a marathon and I figured I'd run one too. You know, right. So you have to decide, is this relevant to my goals? And your goals really should all lead you to this theme of who do I want to be?
Boom. Yeah. Yeah, dude, so good. And I think that comes down to some extent, self-awareness, right? Which is something you also talk about, I know, in your book. And you say that most people think that they know themselves pretty well, but have never really spent the time alone from a third person point of view to try to understand why they do things the way that they do. So let me ask you, what do you think true self-awareness looks like? What does that look like?
I think self-awareness is the ability to step outside of yourself on a regular basis and see your behavior, to audit your thought life from an unbiased perspective. Now, I say unbiased with a grain of salt because it's impossible. Our psychology will always have a first person bias. But being able to look back, let's say, I mean, self-awareness has a double-edged sword, but let's say you make a bad joke, but in the moment you're like, that was so dumb. You know, like you're self-aware right away. And you're not wondering, why isn't everybody laughing? You know, you're like, no, right away. Like I am aware that that was dumb. Or you aren't feeling good today. Mm. Some people might default and be like, I'm depressed. And you're like, well, no. Let me think through and reflect on, I didn't get great sleep last night. That's a contributing factor. Also, yesterday I was so go. I only ate twice and I normally eat 3 or 4 times. That could have affected my central nervous system and my energy levels, right? And so being able to step back and be self-aware and be like, you know what, today's actually not that bad of a day. I'm just physiologically not in tune because I haven't taken good care of myself. So that's self-awareness right there. Or to get in an argument and to be able to take a step back and say, although I'm in this argument, and I'm going head first, I actually think I might be wrong. So let me pivot real quick in the argument and say, oh man, Mitch, let me circle back. I think I might be wrong about this thing that I said. As I think about it, as it comes out of my mouth, it doesn't sound the same in my head. And I'm sorry about that, right? Like that type of self-awareness where you can do it in the moment, or at least you can do it in a short retrospect, is powerful, man. You become someone that I believe people want to be around more. You become someone that's easier to follow because a self-aware leader knows his strengths and weaknesses. And so self-awareness is just the ability to like self-audit your actions, your behavior, and your thought life on a regular basis and ask yourself, why do I do the things that I do? Why do I talk the way that I talk?
Right.
Why do I think certain things are funny to me and certain things aren't? Why is certain food good to me and not? Why do I experience nostalgia in these instances? So it's like really, really understanding yourself.
Right. Yeah. So true. I think it's asking the question why, and there's many ways you can develop this. I think for some it's journaling, for some it's just self-reflection, right? It's like at the end of the day being like, okay, I feel kind of off today. What did I eat? Who did I talk? Who spent time with? What kind of things did I do? Did I put my time towards? And then carrying that knowledge forward with you, and continuing to do that as a part of an ongoing process. And I think we can also go back to what we kind of started the show with, which was you talking about the power of connection. And I think connection is another place where we can get that objective self-awareness that perhaps we are too biased to see ourselves, right? Just having close connections and people in our life who can be like, dude, you're stepping away from, I know, the dude you can be with what you're doing right now. Do you think that's also a piece of that?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. To have people to be comfortable enough in your life to say, you're not being yourself today. What's going on? Or the past couple of weeks, you've been more fun to be around or less fun to be around or more high strung or more free spirited, right? It's not always a bad thing. But to have people that can speak into your life, whether it's good or bad, is powerful, man. And I think learning the value of criticism is super important. And if people know you well and give you that constructive criticism, then it's a very weighty form of criticism.
Wow, that's so true. And I don't remember what podcast I was listening to, but there was an NBA player was being interviewed, and he was talking about how he said the best players that he had ever come across were the guys who can accept criticism openly, where they would be, you know, play in a certain way, and a teammate or a coach would be like, oh no, dude, I think if you did this, you know, you could be more successful. And then they actually go like, oh yeah, maybe I don't know everything. I'll try that. And that was what this particular NBA player said was the key to the success for the best players in the league.
Absolutely.
Okay. You've got another quote in your book, by the way, tons of just awesome quotes in your book, I must say.
Thanks,
but
man.
The one that hit me the hardest was it's from Bronnie Ware. And it's basically in the book, she says that the greatest regret that people had on their deathbed, I think she was a palliative care nurse, was I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected me to. So good.
Yeah.
What does living a life true to yourself mean to you, Jared?
To me specifically or generally?
Let's say both. Let's say both.
Well, generally, I think that is defined differently for everybody. Yeah. And you've got to do the work to figure that out, which is where the self-awareness piece comes. And sort of the entire clarity chapter is written for people to gain clarity in their life on what your personal mission is. What are your values? Like, what are the things that you value? Is it family? Is it money? Is it making a difference? Is it generosity? Is it friendships? Is it football? Like, I mean, your values right. could range, you know, and it's okay if it's money, you know, within context. So defining those things for yourself and then living a life true to that, right? So if family is a major value, if friendships and free time are a major value, then you probably shouldn't be the workaholic entrepreneur. That's not you. It's irrelevant. And that's okay. You can be a strong contributing member of society and be a stay-at-home mom with four kids or one, you know? So you have to define what is your mission, what are your values, and those can shift throughout seasons of your life. But as long as you're living a life true to those, but if you're living a life that's countercultural to the values that you've set, then it's going to, I believe, cause sort of a mental discrepancy, which can lead to anxiety and depression, because if you're not being yourself for a long period of time, that's an identity crisis. And that can be very bad for your mental health, we'll just say. So, and then of course, like if you're investing all your time and money into the wrong people and the wrong things, then you're not living a life true to yourself. And that in your deathbed will be the greatest regret. And that's what Bronnie Ware talks about. And for the audience, a palliative care nurse is basically someone who treats people in their deathbed. And so, you know, she's talking to these people that are dying, and a lot of them have these regrets of living a life to please others too much, because there is too much. Living a life as workaholics, living a life pursuing money instead of people. And
right.
Storing money instead of being generous. And so there's a lot of different ways to live our lives that are countercultural to what Western society tells us we should do. And we got to take the time to think about that. And I think the three best ways to do that is journaling and asking your questions. Mm-hmm. Write it down. Who do I want to be?
Yeah.
What do I value? And then taking the time to sit there, you might have writer's block. You most likely will if it's your first time. And then prayer and meditating, right? So if you're not a believer, I think everybody kind of has their own way of praying, even if they don't believe in a creator. But prayer and meditation, those can go hand in hand for a lot of people, but taking some time, like you mentioned, alone, reflecting, whether you use a meditation app or not, 15 minutes of silence can seem like a lifetime, but you can learn a lot about yourself. And so, you know, to live a life of fulfillment looks different for everybody, but I think that's what it means, living a life true to yourself. And then for me, you know, my mission is to encourage, educate, and empower others to live happier, healthier lives. It's a broad mission, but that's sort of how, and sort of in that order, I want to be an encouraging person, but I don't want to be an inspirational speaker that doesn't give you anything of substance. Right. So I'm an educator at heart. I'm a teacher, right? So I sort of like, I love to be encouraging, but I'm also going to teach you things because it's my nature. And then not only do I want to teach you, I want to lead you to the water, but I want to teach you how to drink, right? So I want to empower others to live happier, healthier lives, which is why I wrote a book, right? It's why I have right. a podcast. It's why I started a meal prep company. Right. And so that's my mission in life. And then of course it's like, who do you want to be? I want to be known as one of the greatest leaders that ever lived. And that doesn't mean like I need to be the next Billy Graham or the president of the United States or Martin Luther King Jr. But I want the people that knew me the best to say that I was one of the greatest leaders that they knew. And that could be 10 people when I die. Or it could be a million, but the people that actually know me, I want them to agree on that. And I have to fulfill that character. So, you know, so that's one of like, who do I want to be? I want to be one of the greatest leaders. And then I want to put a dent in the universe by making health and wellness one of the most convenient and attractive lifestyles to live. So what Steve Jobs did to the iPhone, I want to do to exercise and nutrition. I don't know how, but that's what I want to do. And so I say that as a big thing. And then I say, okay, well, how do I do that? First of all, I take really good care of myself because I have to set the example.
Ooh, yeah.
And then what are some other steps? Okay, start a meal prep company. You know what I mean? Like, how do I accomplish this major overarching goal? It happens in the day-to-day. So that is a life true to myself, right? So if I end up partying all weekend, get back into drugs like I was when I was a teenager, stop exercising as much, stop teaching people, stop hosting my podcast, stop writing, then I'm living a life countercultural to who it is I wanted to be, and I'm going to regret it forever.
Oh, man, awesome stuff. I love how the biggest thing I noticed as you were taking us through that was like, wow, this is in incredible detail. Like he's given some serious thought to this, and it sounds like everything you do now with the podcast, the book, coaching, your nutrition company, it all ties back to that kind of mantra that you've set in alignment with your values. And listening to this, I would imagine it's probably tempting to be like, oh shit, like I don't have a mantra. Like I'll come up with one this afternoon. But I would imagine, Jared, that was a process to come to what you just described to us in about 2 minutes.
Yeah, you got to start somewhere, right? So if you decide to make up one on the moment, cool. But continue to curate it. I would take more time. Maybe set a goal that within the next 2 weeks, I will have a mission statement. And then 2 weeks after that, I will have my values defined. My five values are love, fitness, leadership, growth, and generosity. Right. So whatever I do, whoever I'm spending my time with, I have to love it. And that doesn't mean that I like it. It's different, but I have to love it. Growth. I got to grow in everything. Not everything, but I have to be growing all the time. And so I know that maybe I can't grow in my fitness right now. Let me grow in my knowledge. If I can't grow in my knowledge, let me grow in my confidence and take better care of myself. If I can't grow in that, let me grow in my connections. So growth is a big deal for me. Leadership. I'm a natural born leader, but that doesn't mean I'm a good one. So I have to work on that. And then fitness, of course, like if it's related to fitness, it fires me up. And that's how I've always been. And then, generosity. Like I have, been relatively successful over the past couple years, and it's uncomfortable because it's not the way that I grew up. And so I made a commitment to myself that I will always be a generous person because God has been so generous with me. And the opportunities that I've been able to take advantage of despite the hardships and the adversity. And so I want to be a person known for generosity. On my deathbed, I want people to read my values and say, these make sense, instead of like, this isn't the Jared that I know. You know what I mean?
Do I have the right Jarrett?
Yeah. And that's just, so I want to be known as someone, I tell people, like close friends, not so close friends, I love them all the time. My staff, love you. It's weird to some people, but it's just like, if this is the last time we talk, I want you to know that I love you. You know what I mean? Now I don't say that all the time, 'cause that's weird, but just passing, it's like, all right, love you, bro. You know? And then fitness, right? Like people have, if anybody's known me over the past 15 years, it's fitness. Everybody knows I'm all about growth. I wrote a book about it, right? And so these are things that define me. Mm-hmm.
Awesome stuff, man. Okay. And to be conscious of time, I just want to mention this one piece of your book that I read it and I was like, oh God, I totally resonate with Jarrett on this one. You talk about how you were 4'11" until grade 11. And, I don't know if you had this growing up, but they would line us up based on our height in like elementary, middle school. And I was always either the last in the line, like the very shortest or like second shortest. There'd be a girl behind me or something. But, you know, I was in the back of the line till grade 11 as well. And then like a bean sprout up to, you know, whatever I am now. So I resonate with that. But you said you learned something from this slow growth. Can you talk about quickly what you learned from your being short for most of your childhood?
Yeah, man. So, you know, as a kid, I wasn't raised a believer, but I prayed a lot. And the thing I prayed about mostly was growing. And so I did not want to be 4'11 my whole life. And I was watching all my friends and, you know, obviously like usually people have their first growth spurt in like seventh grade. I got into ninth grade. I was 4'11", 95 pounds. And I was so scared that I'd always be like cute little Jarrett. Cause the girls loved me cause I was cute and little. And I'm like, well, I have a different attraction to you than you do to me, you know, like, and so I think going into my junior year, I was like 5'1". So I'd grown slowly but surely 2 inches, but still everyone's like anywhere from 6 inches to a foot taller than me at this point. Junior year, I didn't hit puberty yet. I was like, I knew clearly I was way behind. And so my junior year, I grew about six, seven inches. And it was painful. You could feel it at night. Like I would be woken up in the middle of the night, middle of the day in class, just these growing pains, but they were sort of affirming, you know, you feel the pain, but you know, it's good. Because I had asked for this. And so, you know, it sort of illustrates the point that growth is painful. Rapid growth is really painful, but take joy in that pain because hopefully it's what you asked for and it's what you're designed for. We're supposed to grow, but it's not always going to feel good, but the end result is fantastic. I love not being 4'11 anymore. And if I could grow some more, that'd be great. But like you go to the gym and every good workout is painful,
right?
Because you're growing. You're breaking down the tissues in your muscles so that they can heal and be bigger and stronger, right? So growing pains is normal and it's natural. But a lot of people avoid it, which is why they avoid a life of constant growth.
Because it's uncomfortable. Oh, man. I love that. Love that. And good to see that you have achieved your growth goals after all. All right, man. Thanks so much for doing this. This is the final question I ask all guests on the show. The question being, if you could send a message to the version of yourself that was at the lowest point of your life, AKA rock bottom, what would that message be?
That's a good question. I would tell myself so many things. So I'm trying to, I needed a lot of advice back then. I still do.
Right.
I want to articulate my words really well here.
Take your time, my man.
Okay. Stop breaking the law. Spend your money wisely and put God first. one sentence, two commas.
Love it. Love it. All really good advice. All three of those things. Dude, thanks so much for doing this. Where can our listeners go to follow you, connect with you, perhaps purchase your book?
Yeah, the book will be on Amazon or really anywhere online that you buy books, the self-help book. My website is jaredgrabiel.com, and you can find me on Instagram at jaredaxlgrabiel.
Beautiful. Jared Axel Grabiel, thanks, my man. Enjoy the rest of your day. Good luck with the book launch, and let's keep in touch.
Thanks, brother. Thanks for having me.